Can you stay curious a little bit longer? Can you rush to action and advice giving a little bit more slowly? So you can see I'm not saying don't give advice and don't be solutions and don't claim authority. I'm saying, can you stay curious a little bit longer? And most people, and this is certainly my experience of financial advisors, is they're not very curious at all. They're like, okay, I'm going to take you through my pro forma. Yeah. I've got your answers. Right, now let me sell you. Now let me prove my authority. And it's this willingness to allow your client or your prospect to be a star, for you to be curious about them, that actually gives them a sense of a kind of safety around that.
This is Bridging the Gap with your host, Matt Reiner.
Michael Bungay-Sanyer, Toronto. How are you doing, my friend? Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm doing great. It's lovely to join you. I'm a transplanted Australian, but I've ended up in Canada and I've made it my home. So I'm waving to you kind of north of the border, I guess.
Yeah, you definitely don't have the Canadian accent. I can tell that. That's for sure, right?
I've got some weird accent that is somewhere in between England and Australia and the US, where I lived for a while in Boston, and Canada. Plus I have a cleft lip and palate, so I have a speech impediment on top of that. So nobody ever knows where the accent comes from.
Yeah. Hey, you're always keeping people on their toes. There's something to be said about that, right? And there's a lot of traveling between Australia to Canada, so there's a lot of land to cover. That's where you take on a lot of new understandings of different cultures, et cetera, from there. But we're not going to talk about travel. I mean, I would love to pick your brain on Australia. I think it's a super interesting country that I've never been to. But
yeah,
we're going to dive into a lot of things around curiosity. I know you've recently wrote a book. You got your own company that helps with curiosity and problem solving and everything of that nature that we're going to dive into. And I really love this topic for this industry today, because we're always shifting and evolving as an industry. And one of those evolutions is evolution of the services we provide, how we provide that, the technologies we utilize. So we're going to dive into all of that here. But before we do, I'm always curious for my guests, what did the 13-year-old Michael Bungay-Stanyer want to be when he grew up?
He wanted to be a 16-year-old who had a girlfriend. That was probably about as far as I could guess. You know, 13, I was enthusiastic at school. I loved reading. I loved, English as a subject. I loved other subjects less. But honestly, I had no idea as a 13-year-old what I wanted to be. I didn't have that sense of purpose. I mean, I remember hitting 18 and suddenly going, I have to figure out what I'm studying at university. And even that was a bit of a random guess. I reckon I finally figured out what I wanted to be when I grew up, when I was about 35. That's actually when I got fired from my last kind of career job and by necessity started my own business. And I'm still wrestling with that. You know, I'm like, the interesting question is actually kind of not what you want to do, but who are you trying to be? How do you keep evolving that kind of sense of who you are and how you show up in the world and the impact you want to have? And, that's an ongoing question. It's more interesting that I don't know how to answer it still.
Yeah. Well, talk to us about kind of that journey that you were mentioning there, right? Going from 13 to 16, wanting a girlfriend, and then 18, and then thinking about what you need to do for university. And then what you mentioned there at 35, starting your own business. Between that, where was that journey? What did that path look like to help you gain more data points on understanding what you wanted to be and who you wanted to be?
Yeah. One of my favorite quotes is, inspiration is when your past suddenly makes sense. So, a lot of this stuff is clearer in retrospect than kind of looking forward. But there were a few kind of tipping points, crossroad moments for me that made all the difference. One was in my mid-20s, where I won a Rhodes Scholarship that took me from Australia to England to study. And that was brilliant for two reasons. Number one reason by a mile is I got to meet my wife at Oxford, where she was also studying. She's Canadian. The other reason, which is not far behind, is it stopped me from becoming a lawyer, because I'd done a law degree in university. I finished my law degree being sued by one of my professors for defamation, so it really wasn't going well. but you know how you're like, you've got sunk costs, and you're like, well, even though I'm being sued, even though I'm not good at law and I'm being sued by professors, I'd probably do the next stage of study and then become a lawyer. And I just would have been an incompetent and unhappy lawyer. So that made a big difference. And then my first job when I finally got out of university was in the world of innovation and creativity. So I was helping organizations invent new products and services. So, you know, on my resume, I can proudly boast that I've played a very small role in helping invent stuffed crust pizza for Pizza Hut and a single malt whiskey that has been described as the very worst single malt whiskey ever invented. And the importance of this was kind of threefold. One is I didn't want to have those two products be the highlight of my career. Like if I died with a tombstone saying he played a small role in stuffed crust pizza, it would not have been a life well lived. Secondly, though, you had to learn how to ask good questions and listen, because we'd go and we'd run focus groups and we'd talk to people. And you had to understand, you had to listen, like, what are they not saying, but they are saying? And that turned out to be a kind of key engine around curiosity and the key thing that I became known for through the coaching habit book. And the third thing is that the guys who started it, for all their flaws, they had some of those, they were very much like, let's not do business as usual. And I do think that often your first job kind of breaks you. It's like, this is how you now have to behave as an adult. And they were very much, look, you've got long hair, you've got earrings, you sew your own clothes, you're weird, but you're smart and we like you. And so there was a permission to kind of be myself there that was really helpful as well. And then kind of, you know, I worked there for a while. I worked as a consultant for a while. I worked in-house for a while. And probably the third crossroad that made the difference was living in Boston. I'd lined up a consulting job in Canada because we decided to move to Toronto. My flight out of Boston was on 9/11. So with all the stuff around that, my job that I'd lined up also vanished. So I got a temporary job, which I wasn't very good at, and I finally got fired from that. And that made me start my own business. And I turned into a bit of an accidental entrepreneur. But that's worked out very well for me. You know, now I've got a couple of multi-million dollar businesses and I've written a bunch of books. It gave me permission to find myself as an entrepreneur.
That is an incredible story. And I love how you break it out into the crossroads and the three different crossroads. And I'm curious from that journey that you went on, the challenges that you may have faced, or maybe the things that you say benefited you from being kind of the accidental entrepreneur, right? Because I think a lot of people go in wanting to be an entrepreneur, or focused on being an entrepreneur, thinking that's the way they are. And they have their own set of challenges and also strengths. But from the accidental side, what was some of those challenges that you didn't know, but also as you look at other entrepreneurs that you think you benefit from by being accidental and not being so determined to be an entrepreneur?
Yeah. Well, the first was having extremely low standards for myself. Like I'm going, if you can make enough money for us to buy food and pay rent, you are crushing it. And so when I started off, I was like, it is a miracle that I am earning more than $10,000 a year doing this. And in fact, I remember my second year breaking through the kind of six-figure number in the revenue and just going, this is extraordinary. I have no clear idea how I'm doing this, but somehow I'm not sucking badly enough that I'm actually making some money. But I think underneath that, one of the things that I've learned, and this kind of really connects, I think, to the folks who are listening to this podcast, is getting a better understanding of what truly is at risk. So I like taking risk because actually when I think about it, not that much is at risk for me. You know, it's typically time or money or reputation. So if I've chosen to do something, the money, the time is like, well, I'm taking the gamble. I'm thinking that this is going to be fulfilling for me, even if it doesn't succeed. The reputation is like, well, you know, I barely have any reputation. Almost nobody thinks about me or cares about me. So I'm probably over precious about my reputation. I don't have to worry about it too much. And then with the money, you can go, well, how much am I prepared to lose? What's the downside look like around that? You know, the very first book I published was a self-published book. And I'd inherited $30,000 when my grandfather died. And we had this bonus money, and it was, it is a lot of money, but it was a lot of money at the time. But my wife and I said, look, it's mine to play with. I get to lose this money if need be. And it gave me the kind of the courage and the permission to self-publish, put a book out in the world. We made the money back and then some, but I was willing to lose it. And so I think the thing that's really helped me continue to be an entrepreneur is, look, I'm not that savvy about how to make money, but I am good at understanding what's at risk and being willing to take a risk as a result.
Yeah. I think what you said early on about having low standards, I think entrepreneurs see all the uber successful founders and they shoot for that. And the journey to get there takes so long that they get continuously demoralized at each level. And so they either end up quitting or they end up pivoting too quickly or too much and losing focus. And yeah. I think that there's something really there of just going in with the expectation of, I just want to do this because it seems like something I would really enjoy doing, and doing it for that.
Yeah.
And understanding that you're risking, you know, you may not be able to put food on the table, but committing to that for a period of time.
Yeah. Also, it's clear that I am increasingly unemployable. Like, nobody in their right mind would actually ever give me a job. And I'm like increasingly snarky about what sort of job I'd want to do anyway. So I'm like, you kind of got to make this work, Michael, because nobody's going to give you a job. So figure it out.
Yeah. You're putting your own constraint on yourself to where you have to figure it out. I am curious, before we jump into, I want to jump into psychological safety and some challenges with change. But before we do, you mentioned that one of your first jobs where you had a small impact on the stuffed crust at Pizza Hut, which to some would be a life well lived.
Exactly.
I mean, congrats, like you did it. You made an impact on many people's lives. So
thank you.
You know, judgment of that is the eyes of the beholder. But you said that the first job was in innovation and creativity.
Yeah.
I don't know how many years ago that was, but I'm curious how that type of role, because it seems like if that was 15 or 20 years ago, that was like a leading edge role, a cutting edge role. Mm-hmm. Now more and more companies are getting that. I'm curious, because you work with companies on curiosity, which leads to creativity and innovation, et cetera. How has that type of role changed from when you were doing it in your first job to now, with more companies involved? What does that differences look like?
Yeah, you know, so I started that job closer to 30 years ago, which is embarrassing. I mean, how old am I?
You're not that. Okay. I mean, so you did
okay,
that at what, 10?
Young
you
I am.
Started at 10 years old?
Yeah,
that's exactly. Unbelievable.
And so at the time, nobody really knew what innovation was. I remember us kind of having to try and explain it, and me trying to explain it to my family, and nobody understanding what the hell I was doing. And I think one of the things that's happened is innovation is normalized. Like, people know what we're talking about when we say innovation now. I also think there are just better ways or different ways to understand what problem you're trying to solve and how you might understand different ways of solving that problem, and also different ways of iterating solutions to that problem. When I did it, I'd run a focus group. I'd talk to a whole bunch of people. I'd try and figure out what their unexpressed needs were. You know, Henry Ford famously said, if I'd asked people what they wanted, they'd have said a faster horse. So you need to get a better idea than just a faster horse. And then I'd sit down with an artist and he'd draw up a whole series of sketches, or maybe I'd sit down with a chef and she would make a whole bunch of different foodstuffs. And then I'd go back to the people and we'd try it and we'd taste it again. So there's many more tools now that can accelerate that and make it faster. And there's almost certainly better discipline around measurement and testing some of that. But actually, in some ways, the core is the same, which is go talk to people, figure out what pain they really have, what problem you're really solving. Do your best to innovate in a way that makes your solution feel different or different enough. And then create prototypes and test that and test it before you take it to the market. So I think the deeper rhythm's the same, but the process, the instruments you play, the baseline is the same, but the instruments you play for the rhythm section are changed.
Yeah. And the skill sets, like you're saying, right? The tools that are there, the instruments that are there are more abundant, and anybody can go and create a quick prototype of a test in seconds instead of days or weeks. And you can get tests and anybody can do that, which is, you know, a rapid innovation.
It's a challenge with any service-based solution as well, because my guess is that if you're a financial advisor, the challenge you've got is you know what you want to sell. Mm-hmm. So you're like, hey, new person, client, I've already got the solution to what I'm pretty sure is your problem. An inability to stay curious about how they talk about their problem gives you an inability to actually customize what you do and how you do it to serve them and go, look, I'm actually a solution to the problem you have.
It's the overconfidence bias that we have in an industry that we know what they want, when actually in reality, we may not, and they may have a different, it may not hit as well as we think it would.
Right. So, you know, my latest book is How to Work with Almost Anyone. And it's about how do you build the best possible relationship with the key people in your working life, you know? And as an advisor, you know, that might be your team or a boss if you have those, but it's definitely your clients and your prospects. And when we come in going, all right, let me tell you, I've already got the solution. I'm already the expert. Let me tell you how things go. You ironically make things less safe for the people you're trying to serve. And when things are less safe, they are in opting out of the conversation with you rather than opting in. So let me just do a tiny bit of teaching around how neuroscience works. So I think this might be helpful for people. 5 times a second, people's brains are going, is it safe here or is it dangerous? Safe or dangerous, risk or reward. And the brain has over tens of thousands of years gone, we are looking for safety because safe means survival. And you know, your brain's only purpose is to keep you alive longer. So safe or dangerous. And there are 4 levers or kind of influences that the brain uses to gauge whether it's safe or dangerous. Tribe, expectation, rank, and autonomy. So terra, T-E-R-A, tribe, expectation, rank, or autonomy. And so when the brain is thinking about tribe, it's basically saying, are you with me or are you against me? Are you with me or are you against me? And if you're with them, they'll feel safer. And if you're against them, they feel less safe. Expectation is, do I know what's about to happen or do I not know what's about to happen? And if I know what's going to be happening, I feel safer. And if I'm like, I'm not quite sure what's going on, you feel less safe. Rank is, do I feel more or less important than you? If I feel more or equally important, I feel safer. If I feel less important, I can feel less safe. And autonomy is, do I have any say in this or are you making all the choices for me? And the classic behavior of an advisor is they come in and they lower the sense of tribiness because it's like, I'm here and you're there. I'm on this firm, you're there. I'm sitting across the table from you and you're over there or I'm through a screen. So there's not that sense of connection. There's not that sense of we. It's me and it's art and it's me and you. Expectation is like you don't signpost as to what's happening. So people are constantly kind of feeling uncertain. Rank, I've got a higher rank than you because I know stuff about finances and you don't, so I'm smarter than you. And autonomy is I'm giving you minimum choices. So there's a whole way that often, and I'm saying this because I literally before this call, I got off a call with my financial advisor of 15 years. And she's been my financial advisor for 15 years, having gone through a bunch of them in the previous 10, because she knows how to do this terra quotient and make it safe and make me feel part of it and make me feel part of her tribe and get clear expectations and raise my rank and give me a sense of autonomy. And it means that I'm much more likely to be safe and engaged with her, which means I'm likely to stick with her.
So let's, because that gets into psychological safety. And I want to talk about psychological safety because I think psychological safety is super interesting. I think it's necessary to create a culture of creativity, a culture of curiosity, a culture of innovation. So I think from a culture and team standpoint, I want to dive into it. But you just brought something super interesting up, which is from the client side, the end user side. And I think that the understanding of Terra, which is super interesting, I think can resonate in both of those areas. But I want to dive into the client side first.
Sure.
When you think about the creating that with a client, there's this balance that I think has to be had between an advisor and their client, where the client wants to know what to do because they're coming to the experts. So the advisor feels they need to tell them what to do to provide them the value and also to make them seem valuable enough for the fees that are being paid.
Of course.
But there's like this fine line. When you do that, then you're lowering Terra. You're not having as much Terra, right? You're lowering autonomy and rank and everything of that nature. So, but you need a balance there. So how does that balance look in a client to advisor relationship? Like maybe your advisor, how does your advisor help you understand or feel connected through the Terra methodology?
So the book that I'm best known for is a book called The Coaching Habit. The purpose of The Coaching Habit is to kind of unweird coaching for the rest of us. It's not designed for coaches. It's designed for people who need to be in conversation with other people. And at the heart of The Coaching Habit is a singular behavior. It's just kind of my definition of coaching, actually. That behavior is this. Can you stay curious a little bit longer? Can you rush to action and advice giving a little bit more slowly? So you can see I'm not saying don't give advice and don't be solutions and don't claim authority. I'm saying, can you stay curious a little bit longer? And most people, and this is certainly my experience of financial advisors, is they're not very curious at all. They're like, okay, I'm going to take you through my pro forma. Yeah. I've got your answers. Right, now let me sell you. Now let me prove my authority. And it's this willingness to allow your client or your prospect to be a star, to guide it, to for you to be curious about them, that actually gives them a sense of a kind of safety around that. And then there is a place for you to establish your bona fides, your kind of your authority, your status, your knowledge. You can just take longer than you think. Now, if people want a deeper dive on this, I've got a TEDx talk called How to Tame Your Advice Monster. And it actually talks about kind of the damage you do and the gap you create if you rush too quickly into advice giving. And just to reiterate, there is definitely a place for advice and solutions and opinions and expertise. And if it is your default response, which is what it is for many of us, then there's a way that that doesn't serve you.
It's something that I become self-aware of, right? With curiosity and also with relationships, is this idea of right when I hear of a problem, my mind goes straight to solutioning. I have to take a break and move back because there is this aspect of a lot of people may not want a solution. They just want you to hear them and understand them. And the key of curiosity seems to be that, you know, what I've learned and you have it on your website, on the Box of Crayons website, crayons. I never say it the right way. My wife always gives me a hard time on it, but is that curiosity comes from the Latin of to care.
Yeah.
And that's really what curiosity is you care deeply enough by listening or researching deeply enough. And so then the question gets to is, can you learn curiosity? And is curiosity, so it's a double question, is curiosity the foundation to create psychological safety?
Well, let me answer them one by one. First is, can you learn curiosity? And the answer is you absolutely can learn curiosity. And you almost have to unlearn advice giving. Because what happens when somebody comes to you and goes, hey, here's my problem, is your advice monster looms up out of the dark and goes, oh, I'm going to add some value to this conversation. Watch me go. Even when they don't say, here's my problem, even if they just start talking, after about 10 seconds, you're like, yeah, I know what they need from me. Like, I don't know them. I don't really know the other people involved. I don't really know the challenge. But after 10 seconds, I've got some ideas and I'm just waiting to share them. I'm just waiting for that break in the internet. So it's like, it's not just what you're adding, it's what you're subtracting. So these two books I've written about this, The Coaching Habit, is like, here are the seven questions. And if you use these seven questions, that's going to allow you to stay curious with most people in a useful way most of the time. They're not the only questions in the world, but they're seven really good, reliable, multi-purpose, multi-use questions. But then the book that followed that is called The Advice Trap. And it's a kind of deeper dive in how do you tame your advice monster? Because with The Coaching Habit, I found, you know, because it's sold over 1 million copies now. Like lots and lots of people were like, the seven questions are everything. It's changed the way I show up. It's changed the relationship I have with my kids, with my clients, with my team, my boss. But there's a bunch of people who went, look, I've got the seven questions and I like them. I put them on my monitor so I remember them. And I keep defaulting back into giving advice. What's going on around that? And that's when we get into the three different advice monsters. Why giving advice makes you feel better about yourself at the cost of you being in service to the people across the table from you that you're trying to help. So that's the answer to the first question, which is you absolutely can learn curiosity and you have to work at it. The book is called The Coaching Habit because it's like, here's how habits work. And you're trying to actively build a habit around this and unlearn some old habits as well.
So And then I want to dive into that second question, which is curiosity the foundation of psychological safety? Is one of those issues with asking the questions and taming the advice monster, is it because we're always searching for being valued or we're searching for acceptance and we feel that by asking just lots of questions, people get annoyed and it doesn't show that we're actually, that we're doing anything?
Yeah. So the three advice monsters, they're really just kind of metaphors for these kind of three core drivers, three ego states, if you want to get kind of more therapy speak, about what makes us want to give advice. So the three advice monsters are tell it, save it, and control it. So tell it says, this is the message you've got in your brain, the way I prove that I am useful and valuable is I have all the answers to all the things. And that's why I'm here. I'm supposed to be the fount of knowledge. Now, of course, in these days of Google 5 years ago, ChatGPT now, it's like, honestly, I can find answers to anything better and faster than you. But we still carry this burden, which is like, I'm supposed to be the person who has ideas, that provides solutions, that has the deeper knowledge. And of course, there's a place for that. Just it's not as valuable as you might think. The second advice monster is the save it advice monster, which is like, my job is to save the world, keep everybody safe, make everybody have a good life, make sure nobody has any stress or any challenge or any kind of issues at any of the time. I need to protect all the people all the time. Again, impossible. And again, coming from a good place, which is like, I'm trying to be a champion for people. I'm trying to be helpful here, but exhausting and impossible. And of course, just as in with the first one, a tell it, if you're the person with the ideas and the solutions, it means nobody else gets a chance to have ideas and have solutions. If you're the person who saves people all the time, nobody gets to actually go through the learning growth of doing hard things and kind of figuring themselves out and learning and growing. And then the third advice monster is control it, where you're like, my job is to keep my hands on the steering wheel and fend off chaos and fend off the future and guarantee certainty in everything. And, you know, financial advisors know anything. It would be that there's nothing guaranteed. That's what all the small print's always about. You know, past results don't guarantee future results, right? But we want to kind of like pretend that if I just do that, maybe I can fend off the uncertainty and ambiguity of the future. But that then doesn't allow the future to arrive. It doesn't allow for serendipity. It doesn't allow for people to step up and take control. So we've got all sorts of ego-based reasons to go, look, it's better for me to just tell people what to do.
Is it bad if I fall into have all those monsters on my shoulders and one of them on my head? So one on each shoulder and one on my head?
Pretty sure it makes you human rather than bad. I mean, I think most of us have versions of these different advice monsters. One of the most powerful shifts for anybody is to say, the way you add value is to be the person who figures out what the real problem is rather than the person who figures out what the answer is. And look, I'm not a financial advisor, it's obvious, but I can guess if you come into a relationship with a current or a potentially new client and you're like, I'm going to help you really figure out what's hard about money and what you're most longing for in terms of what you'd like your money to do, and what matters most to you, if I can help you figure that out, then the solution becomes easy. And I want to, you know, and I'm keen to hear the solution from you. But you've got to help me understand the challenge before you can sell me the solution.
Mm. I think that's super interesting. I think that, you know, it's somewhat, I love the Henry Ford quote. I use it many, many times. And I think that that's something also that as advisors we can learn from, is that we think, And I'm curious to your perception of how to overcome this, maybe in personal experiences or from what you've learned in your work, is that we believe that if we help God, that someone's coming to us to have them manage our money. And so we can ask them, well, what do you want with your money? And they say, well, I just want to retire. And we just take it at face value. And we feel at times that if we keep prying at that, then we're going to get really uncomfortable and our client's going to get really upset. But that's like saying that, we know that goes back to everything, all the challenges, right? That we know all the answers and it gets to Tara and everything of that nature. But how do you see that, or how do you help to overcome that, or what is your belief on that side of it?
Yeah, I think you're pointing to a really present anxiety people have, which is like, I'm supposed to be here adding value, not asking questions, failing to understand that asking questions is often a way of adding value. But what's very true about what you're saying is often the person on the other side of the table, maybe your client, is kind of expecting you to be the person with the answers as well. So they might be going, what the hell's going on here? I just wanted a recommendation, not this kind of probing curiosity. So I would manage that. You can just tell people what's going on, which is like, look, I've got some ideas. I've got some thoughts around what might be helpful for you, but I want to make sure I really get what's going on for you so that the recommendation I give you when it comes is the best one I've got, not just the first one I've got. So I'm going to be nosy and I'm going to get into asking you about what you want. And it doesn't even matter if you don't have all the answers yet. I'm going to help you figure some of this stuff out, because if I can get you to not just, I need to have money enough to retire, but a deeper understanding about what really matters to you around retirement. You know, is it about freedom to do things? Is it about freedom from anxiety and fear? Is it about something else? That then allows me to make sure that what I recommend for you is as tailored for you and as personal for you as is absolutely possible. I don't want to give you just a generic solution. I want to give you your best solution. And to do that, we have to go deeper into, you know, what are you wrestling with? What's hard about this for you? What are you anxious about? What are you assuming about your retirement?
Yeah, I think that that's super interesting, because I think that there's an ability to navigate that to help understand the client and help them understand things themselves, to help them come to their own realizations. But all of this that we're talking about, curiosity, psychological safety, you know, probing a little bit, questioning, et cetera, that a lot of us will likely have to overcome and change at times. There are some changes that we have to do. There's practicing that we have to do. We have to evolve. And we've always, especially as we get older, we get more and more resistant to change.
Yeah.
And it's there's like this negative desire to change. Like if you go into an organization, you want to do some changes, there's always pushback. If you want to do something different with your clients, there's a pushback. But to be creative, to innovate, to be better, mm-hmm. you have to change. And in your idea of the coach-like curiosity, it's like this idea of blending elements of curiosity with coaching, et cetera, which we've talked about. So I'm curious how we can help implement that. You know, if I'm a leader of a firm and I want my advisor to do this, or I'm an advisor and I want to instill this into my own day-to-day with my clients, how can we implement this to help spur openness to change?
I'll attempt to limit this to less than a 14-hour answer. Or
hey, we can, change we're here. We have, you know, we can make it 14 hours. It's Tim Ferriss times four.
It is a huge challenge, and change is messy and complex. I think there are, the first thing that's helpful to understand is there's kind of two levels of change. In a different book I wrote, I call it easy change and hard change. So easy change is a process of, I need to get from A to B, and I'm going to do that by just getting a bit smarter. So you're like, okay, here's what I need to do. So you go out and you read a book, or you listen to a podcast, or watch a masterclass or TEDx or whatever, and you learn a bit and you try a bit, and you learn from that and you learn a bit more and you try a bit and you learn a bit more. And it's a kind of steady evolution to kind of like, you go from, there's a learning hierarchy. You start off as unconsciously incompetent. In other words, you don't realize that you suck. You then have this moment where you're like consciously incompetent, where you're like, man, I suck at this. And that's where people want to give up often with change, because they're like, who wants to suck? We're all in our midlife now. Surely our sucking years are behind us. But actually, that is painful, but it's also really rich, because this is where you're learning the most. You then move to a place where you are consciously competent. In other words, you're good, but you kind of have to think about it. And then you finally get to a place where you're unconsciously competent. In other words, it's just a habit now. It's in your bones. And my bet is, to everybody listening, you can look back on your career as a financial advisor and you can see yourself moving through those phases. You know, year one as a financial advisor, you're like, I'm mostly consciously incompetent. I'm just learning and making stuff up and trying not to screw it up too badly. So that's easy change, which is like you learn it, you practice it, and then you get to that place of being good enough. And that's great. That's helpful. Some of the change requires that. Unfortunately, less than we'd like. A lot of it is hard change. So hard change, and I know people have experienced this, you try and apply the same tactics. I need to move from A to B. All right, I'm gonna read it up, and I'm gonna listen, and I'm gonna study videos. I'm gonna do all of that, and it's just it all just goes to hell in a handbasket. You know, it's like you try it and you give up on it, and it's like New Year's resolutions. You're like, oh man, it's January the 21st. For the 97th year in a row, I've said I'm going to try and do this. And once again, I've failed within the first 2 weeks. What is wrong with me? And what's wrong with you is you're applying the wrong tactics to try and make change happen, because the tactics of easy change, learn and practice, build a habit, don't work for hard change. Hard change is really future you calling you forth. You know, if easy change is like downloading an app on your phone, you know, it's like, oh, it's a useful app. I'm a tiny bit better with that app. Hard change is like, I need an operating system reset. You're trying to redesign a different thing. And the question that is at the heart of hard change is, if I'm going to say yes to this, what must I say no to? And that is a profoundly juicy question. That is a great question for you as advisors to bring to your clients, which is like, if you say you want this, what must you say no to for that to be a real thing? Because it's your no's that give your yeses shape and weight and heft and kind of meaning. But the challenge with no's is you're not just saying no to things, you're saying no to people. Mm. So part of what you're saying no to as you try and change at this hard change level is you're saying no to old versions of yourself. You're saying no to people's expectations of you. You're saying no to expectations you had of yourself, 3 months ago or 6 months ago. And so the realization here is that change has, the status quo has a lot of gravity. It's like it keeps pulling you back to the current way of doing things. So it takes a really active engagement to go, what type of change am I doing here? And if this is hard change, how do I go beyond the just learning the stuff and getting frustrated when it doesn't work to actually wrestling with, what am I committed to right now in the here and now? What must I say no to of those commitments so I can say yes to the next version of who I am and who I want to be and what I want to do?
You know, there's a lot of gold in that. And I think that the challenge, as I listen to you talk, and this is something that I struggle with all the time, is the inability to say no. And when you peel back the onion on that a little bit more, is that it's the expectation of the expectation I set for myself, and now me having to adjust it if I say no to it, to your point of now I'm letting myself down. And then there's this also aspect of, I believe that a lot of people are judging and watching and keeping tallies of my success. And the reality is nobody gives a rat's butt about me. They could care less about me. They worry about themselves. And so overcoming that. And so when you look at companies and organizations and people that lead those organizations that are able to overcome that, what is the makeup of their, or what is the kind of the makeup of their mentality or their focus and their intention that enables them or empowers them, maybe is the right word, to step past those kind of underlying expectations that everybody has internal, whether you say you do or you don't, you have it naturally.
Well, if you're trying to do change at scale, if you're leading an organization, first thing you got to do is you're like, it's not just about how individuals change. You've also got to think about, well, what are the structures in our organizations that need to change? Because our behaviors are most influenced by the structures around us. There's a famous metaphor of an elephant with a rider on it on a path. And that represents the three aspects of kind of broader change. The rational case for change, that's the rider. The emotional case for change, that's the elephant. And then the structural change levers, that's the path. And as a leader, as a kind of leader of change, most people are very drawn to the rational case for change. Let me tell you how doing this differently will add this to the top line and this to the bottom line and increase our net promoter score or whatever it might be. And the rational case for change persuades nobody to do anything differently. But it's the easiest thing to make a case for. And we're like, maybe this will persuade people. And it's like, nope. Nobody's convinced by a rational case for change. Even if it makes perfect sense, they're not going to do anything differently. Emotional case for change, what's in it for me, how's how you'll feel better, that's going to help for sure. But that is also typically insufficient. The thing that really makes a difference is the structural differences that you make. So you're like, if you want somebody to behave in a different way, how do you reorg your company? How do you reorg payment? How do you change titles? How do you change reporting relationships? Winston Churchill said, we shape our buildings and thereafter they shape us. We're talking about the structures that shape our behavior. If you don't want a snack, if if you want to lose weight and you want to stop eating ice cream, I can give you the rational case of why ice cream is nothing but sugar and fat. I can give you the emotional case for not eating ice cream, which is like, you know what, you're going to live longer and you'll play with your grandkids if you don't have a heart attack because you've eaten too much ice cream. But if there's just no ice cream in the house, I'm just not going to eat ice cream. The structural changes make the difference. So if you're trying to lead change at that bigger level, you're trying to do two things that almost feel contradictory. One is around changing the structures of your systems, and the other is asking people individually to make a change for that.
It goes back to making it easy and not thoughtful, like where they have, you don't want them to have to think, or me either. Like, I don't want to have to think about it. Make it easy so that it just becomes part of who I am.
Yeah. But in the end, the capacity to say no comes down to going, I privilege the person I'm trying to be and the impact I'm trying to have on the world more highly than am I liked by people? Because, you know, when we say no to the things, when we say yes to the things we kind of want to say no to, that's when we're like, you know, I'm going to trade off the momentary comfort of not disappointing somebody or not having to say a hard thing. And what you lose is the bigger game that you're wanting to play. It's as simple and as difficult as that. Just like, get a backbone.
Yeah, that is, it's so true. And I love that position of how you do it, that I am more aligned to the impact and the value that I'm going to provide than the view or the opinion, which the opinion really is just a inconsequential choice of someone else. It doesn't have any consequence to it.
So what I try and do is I try and make it as easy for myself as possible. So I'm slightly famous in some small ponds. You know, I'm a small to medium-sized fish in a few ponds. But it means that I get, you know, for instance, invited on a bunch of podcasts, and I can't do all of that because otherwise I'd spend my whole life doing podcasts or doing other stuff for other people. And every time I have to write a no to that, or my assistant has to write a no to that, it's kind of, how do we say it? How do we make this tricky? So we just have a pre-written message on Text Expander. So all I need to do is type in semicolon no, and I get a pre-written message that says, dear name, thank you so much. I'm really touched by the invitation. My focus is fully on my key projects right now, which just means I can't say yes to such a kind invitation. My apologies. Best of luck with it, Michael. And I don't have to think about how to say no. So I'm removing some of the cognitive load by going, your job is just to hit semicolon N-O on your keyboard and you can say no easily.
I love that. And I just want to say for the record, thank you for not sending that one to us.
I did, but you guys ignored it. So here I am.
That's part of the skill that we've learned as well, is how to overcome the no of all the people that tell us no, because that's the only way we have a podcast. Everybody starts with no, and then we have to figure out how to convince them to come back.
That's it.
Before I let you go and before we wrap up, because I want to be cautious of your time, I'm super appreciative of it, but you mentioned there one tactic of helping to eliminate the cognitive load by using something like Typeform, but I'm interested to think about, we talked about like the client side of how to become curious and the Terra methodology, but then I just want to finish and wrap up on curiosity within an organization.
Yeah.
And I'm curious of what types of tactics or processes leaders can implement into their organization to start to evolve a culture of curiosity. Yeah. Maybe one that wasn't, but then one that they want to get to over a period of time, and what you've seen work and maybe not work. Example.
Yeah. So you got those two levels again, structural and individual change. So at a structural level, one of the clients we worked most with is Microsoft. The CEO there was like, I'm going to move us from a culture of know-it-all to a culture of learn-it-all, because we need this for actually to implement our business strategy. And so we've put, I think it's probably close to 30,000 people now through our programs at Microsoft, because Satya Nadella is like, here's the link between culture and strategy and bottom line success. So at that bigger level, you got to figure out why curiosity and coach-like behavior is a good business reason for your organization, so you can make a case for that. At an individual level, you're looking to tame your advice monster. So go watch the Tame Your Advice Monster video. But in the Coaching Habit book, I'm like, here are seven good questions. And if I'm going to give you just one of those seven questions, it might be what I brashly call the best coaching question in the world. And the best coaching question in the world, which is literally an awesome question, is, and what else? A-W-E, and what else? So awesome. And the power in that question is, people's first answers are never their only answers, and they're rarely their best answers. But when you ask a question and you get an answer, you think that's it. Because your advice monster's like, you did it. You asked a question. Let's move on and get into the advice-giving mode. And I'm like, no. They've got more to say. And with the power of and what else is people don't even hear it. They just hear you holding the space for curiosity longer. So if you're a financial advisor and you're asking your clients or your prospects questions, start adding and what else into those conversations, because you're going to learn a lot more and you're going to be seen as more empathetic and more sympathetic. Your clients are going to feel more seen and more heard. And if all of that happens, you're more likely to close a deal.
I love that. I love that. That is incredible. And what else? A-W-E, awe. Just think awe. Or awesome, as you said. Yeah. Michael, this has been a real just pleasure, man. I think we could talk for hours. I've learned so much from you. And I think there's so much more. Everybody can go out and get Michael's books, any of them. They're all fantastic on Amazon. So be sure to do that. Before I let you go, though, Michael, I want to ask you two questions. Speaking of books, and speaking of curiosity, I love learning new things. I'm constantly curious, and I like to learn from people that are a lot smarter than me, like yourself, and I like to do so via reading. So I always like to ask guests, what's one book out there you think everybody should read?
You know, there's a new book that I've just finished reading by a friend of mine called Stephanie Harrison, and it's called New Happy, New Happy, Getting Happiness Right in a World That's Got It Wrong. And so if you'd like to be a little bit happier, or if you think that one of the ways that you can serve your clients is by making them a little bit happier, then this is a book that gives you science behind actually here are the drivers for happiness and here's how you facilitate that.
That's fantastic. I'm going to go out and purchase that right now because we're working on something inside of our organization to help people find purpose. And so that's going to be a driver of that. I love that. And then the last question, and you kind of answered it with AWE, but I wonder if there's something else. But I always like to ask, I mean, we talked about a lot. There's a lot that we didn't talk about that you've been doing for your entire career. If you could give someone one piece of actionable advice to implement today to make them better tomorrow, what would that be?
Yeah, I think, you know, and what else is definitely a candidate for that. But if you're looking for another question, I might offer up the seventh final question from the Coaching Habit book, which is the learning question, which I can ask you now and you'll see its impact. And the learning question is, what was most useful or most valuable for you? Now, we've been talking for an hour, close to it. We've covered a ton of stuff. You've already started to forget it. So if you're a listener, what I'd ask you to do is what would you name as the thing that was most useful or most valuable for you in this conversation? And what you're going to do by naming that to yourself, repeating it to yourself, is you're going to give yourself a much better chance of actually remembering and acting on whatever it was that you found valuable. So you can imagine with your own clients, every time you have a conversation with them, finish by saying, so what was most useful or valuable about this for you? And three things are happening. One is your client will actually name something that was useful and valuable for them. So they'll go, okay, that's good. Secondly, you'll get feedback. So you'll hear what you're doing that's actually working. And thirdly, you are constantly framing every interaction with you as useful and valuable. And if you'd like your clients to keep renewing their contracts with you, then having a relationship that is constantly framed as useful and valuable will be invaluable.
I love that. That is incredible. I mean, that's going to help people, I think, in with their manager leading and also serving families. Michael, you've been incredible. I am so stoked to have met you and built this relationship, and I can't wait to continue to follow you and learn from you. I'm sure many listeners will want to do the same. So what's the best way for people to learn, follow, and potentially work with you?
Yeah. So mbs.works is the personal site, and you can find out from me. All of the books have kind of free resources. So get into some of the book pages and grab whatever you want from there. If you've got a huge training budget at a corporate level, boxofcrayons.com is the place to spend that money for making curiosity a leadership superpower. And mbs.works also gives you access to my socials and Instagram and stuff there. So you'll find me there if you want.
Michael, you are an incredible person. Thanks for all you're doing, man, and all the work you're putting into every industry that you impact. And again, thank you for not saying no to this conversation. It's super appreciative. And stay well, be well, and hope to talk with you again here soon.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Bridging the Gap. Don't forget to give us a rating and let us know what you think.